capitalism's real gravediggers may end up being its own delusional cardinals who've turned ideology into faith. Despite their strategic brilliance, they seem to have trouble grasping a simple fact. Capitalism is destroying the planet. The two old tricks that dug it out of past crises, war and shopping, simply will not work.
That's Arundhati Roy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arundhati Roy, Capitalism, a Ghost Story. Capitalism is fairly universal in its practices, allowing for some differences. The overarching goal is to satiate what one economist called its werewolf hunger for profits. The tar sands project in northern Alberta, the most environmentally destructive operation on Earth, is a case in point. It is proceeding apace because it is a money-making bonanza. There's a telling cartoon in The New Yorker. A CEO of a major corporation is meeting with stockholders who are keen to hear about new dividends. He tells them, "While long-term prospects for the planet are grim indeed, with widespread misery, hunger, and wars, in the short term, there are excellent opportunities for us to make more money." That sums up the prevailing attitude. India has its own brand of rapacious capitalism. While hundreds of millions live in dire poverty, a class of gazillionaires has emerged with Maharaja-like conspicuous consumption. Our guest today is Arundhati Roy of India. In 1997, she took the literary world by storm with her novel The God of Small Things. Since then, according to The Guardian, she's become her country's harshest critic and its most fearless activist. She's the author of many books, including The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, Field Notes on Democracy, and Walking with the Comrades. She gave the Edward Said Lecture at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. And now, Arundhati Roy.
My talk today is called Capitalism, a Ghost Story. And it begins in Mumbai, outside the gates of a tall building called Antila. Is it a house or a home? A temple to the new India or a warehouse for its ghosts? Ever since Antila arrived on Altamount Road in Mumbai, exuding mystery and quiet menace, things haven't been the same. "Here we are," the friend who took me there said. "Pay your respects to our new ruler." Antila belongs to India's richest man, Mukesh Ambani. I'd read about this most expensive dwelling ever built, the 27 floors, 3 helipads, 9 lifts, hanging gardens, ballrooms, weather rooms, gymnasiums, 6 floors of parking, and the 600 servants. But nothing had prepared me for the vertical lawn. A 27-story high soaring wall of grass attached to a vast metal grid. The grass was dry in patches, and bits had fallen off in neat rectangles. Clearly, trickle-down hadn't worked. But gush up certainly has. That's why in a nation of 1.2 billion people, India's 100 richest people own assets equivalent to 1/4 of the GDP. Gush up works beautifully in your country, too. In 2010, U.S. income inequality had returned to what it used to be in 1929, before the Great Depression. The top 1% earns the equivalent of 1/4 of the national income and has assets equivalent to half the national wealth. But the word on the street and in the New York Times is, or at least was, that after all that effort and gardening, the Ambanis don't live in Antila. No one knows for sure, but people still whisper about ghosts and bad luck, vastu and feng shui. Maybe it's all Karl Marx's fault, all that cussing. Capitalism, he said, has conjured up such gigantic means of production and of exchange. It's like the sorcerer who's no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld whom he has called up with his spells. In India, the 300 million of us who belong to the post-IMF reforms middle class, the market, live side by side with the spirits of the netherworld, the poltergeists of dead rivers, dry wells, bald mountains, and denuded forests. The ghosts of 250,000 debt-ridden farmers who've killed themselves, and of the 800 million who have been impoverished and dispossessed to make way for us, and who survive on less than 20 rupees, which is half a dollar a day. But Mukesh Ambani is personally worth $20 billion. He holds majority controlling shares in Reliance Industries Limited, that's RIL, a company with a market capitalization of $47 billion and global business interests that include petrochemicals, oil, natural gas, polyester fiber, special economic zones, fresh food retail, high schools, life science research, and life sciences research and stem cell storage systems. RIL recently bought 95% shares in Infotel, a TV consortium that controls 27 news and entertainment channels in several languages. Infotel owns the only nationwide license for 4G broadband, a high-speed information pipeline, which, if the technology works, could be the future of information exchange. He also owns a cricket team. RIL is one of a handful of corporations that run India. Some of the others are the Tatas, Jindals, Vedanta, Mittals, Infosys, SR, and the other Reliance ADAG, owned by Mukesh's brother. For US equivalents, think about Cargill, Bechtel, Koch Industries. Their race for growth has spilled across Europe, Central Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Their nets are cast wide. The Tatas, for example, run more than 100 companies in 80 countries. They are one of India's oldest and largest private sector power corporations. They own mines, gas fields, steel plants, telephones, cable TV and broadband networks, and they run whole townships. They manufacture cars and trucks, own the Taj Hotel chain, Jaguar, Land Rover, Daewoo, Tetley Tea, a publishing company, a chain of bookstores, a major brand of iodized salt, and the cosmetics giant Lakme. Their advertising tagline could easily be, "You can't live without us." According to the rules of the Gush Up gospel, the more you have, the more you can have. The era of the privatization of everything has made the Indian economy one of the fastest growing in the world. However, if you take a closer look at what's driving its economy, it isn't really the export of consumer products or industrial goods. Like any good old-fashioned colony, what India is exporting are its minerals. The only difference is that some of the corporations involved are owned by Indians. It's a dream come true for businessmen to be able to sell what you don't have to buy. India's new mega corporations are those who've managed to muscle their way to the head of the spigot that is spewing money extracted from deep inside the earth. The other great source of corporate income comes from land grabbing, which is happening all over the world. Chinese billionaires, Wall Street, agribusiness, land holdings are just becoming a new kind of colonization. In India, the land of millions of people is being acquired and made over to private corporations for what is known as public interest, which includes special economic zones, car manufacturer, sports cities, and chemical hubs. As always, local people are told that their displacement from their land and the expropriation of everything they ever had is actually a part of employment generation. But by now we know that the connection between jobs and GDP growth is a myth. After 20 years of growth, 60% of India's workforce is self-employed, and 90% of the labor force works in the unorganized sector. Post-independence, right up to the 1990s, all the radical movements in India, whether it was the extreme left or even right-wing movements, were fighting for the redistribution of land. Land to the tiller was what they said. But today, they have been reduced, even the most radical have been reduced to fighting to hold on to what little land people still have. The hundreds of millions of landless people who are accumulating in the cities like Bombay and Delhi, they're not even in the radical discourse, let alone the corporate or the growth discourse anymore. As Gushup concentrates wealth onto the tip of a shining pin on which our billionaires pirouette, tidal waves of money crash through the institutions of democracy, the courts, the parliament, and the media, leaving their ruined shells to bob around on an ocean of banknotes. The noisier the carnival around elections and democracy, the less sure we are that it really exists. Each new corruption scandal that surfaces in India makes the last one look tame. In the summer of 2011, the 2G spectrum scandal broke, and we learned that in 2008, corporations siphoned away $40 billion of public money. The way they did it was by installing a friendly soul as the Minister of Communications and Information Technology, who then grossly underpriced 2G spectrum and illegally auctioned it to his buddies. Taped telephone conversations leaked to the press showed how the network of industrialists and their front companies, ministers, judges, senior journalists, and a national TV anchor, and even the offices of the Home Minister and Prime Minister were involved in facilitating this daylight robbery. But the privatization and illegal sale of telecom spectrum does not involve war, displacement, and ecological devastation. The privatization of India's mountains, rivers, and forests does. But perhaps because it doesn't have the uncomplicated clarity of a straightforward, out-and-out accounting scandal, or perhaps because it's all being done in the name of India's progress, it doesn't have the same resonance with the middle classes. In 2005, the state governments of Chhattisgarh, Orissa, and Jharkhand, which are states, sort of forested states in central India, signed hundreds of memorandums of understanding, MOUs, with a range of private corporations turning over trillions of dollars of bauxite, iron ore, and other minerals for a pittance, defying even the twisted logic of the free market. So basically, the government sold it for a 0.5 to 7% royalty and just handed over these mountains and rivers. A whole ecosystem is being re-engineered, a whole mostly indigenous population of people numbering in their hundreds of thousands is being devastated. The inviolability of public, of private property, of course, never applies to the poor, to the property of the poor. Only days after the Chhattisgarh government signed an MOU for the construction of an integrated steel plant in Bastar with Tata Steel, the Salwa Judum, a brutal tribal people's militia, was inaugurated. The government said it was a spontaneous people's movement of local people who were fed up of the repression by the Maoist guerrillas in the forest. But actually, it was a ground-clearing operation funded and armed by the government and subsidized by mining corporations. In other states, similar militias were created with other names. The Prime Minister said that the Maoists were the largest, internal security challenge in India. And that became a declaration of war. On the 2nd of January 2006, in Kalinganagar in Orissa, 10 platoons of police opened fire on Adivasi protesters who had gathered at the site of another Tata steel plant to protest what they felt was inadequate compensation for their land. 13 people, including a policeman, were killed and 37 were injured. 6 years have gone by, and the villages remain under siege by armed policemen, but the protest has not ended. Meanwhile, in Chhattisgarh, the Salwa Judum burned and raped and killed its way through the forests, basically emptying something like 600 villages, forcing about 50,000 people to come out into the roadside police camps, and about 350,000 people just went off the radar. Some of them fled to neighboring states, some of them joined the Maoists, and some of them just continued to live in the forest without shelter, too frightened to go to their homes, without food, under siege, the poorest people in India. So when I wrote Walking with the Comrades, it was an account of going into the forest and spending some time walking with the guerrilla army. But eventually the Maoists counterattacked the Salvajurum and pushed it back. So then in a blaze of you know, sort of Fox News type of hysteria about Maoist terrorism and so on, the government announced what it called Operation Green Hunt and sent 200,000 paramilitary troops into the forest. But even that, these heavily armed police and paramilitary went in, and even they met with mass militant resistance in the plains and Maoist ambushes in the forest, and eventually had to retreat to their barracks. So today, the world's greatest democracy, the world's greatest emerging economic superpower, has called out the army against the poorest people in the country. Already about 5,000 troops have moved in, but we are waiting, the army is waiting for the declaration of what it calls the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which allows it to kill on suspicion. And it's been a very suspicious army because it's in Kashmir, Manipur, Nagaland, where it has been deployed, has killed tens of thousands of people. While the preparations for the deployment are being made, the jungles of central India continue to be under siege. People just can't come out of the forest. They can't come to the market. They can't buy medicines because they're called Maoists. There are thousands of people in jail, crowded. The prisons are crowded with Adivasi, indigenous people, who have no idea what their crime is supposed to be. Recently, a school teacher who I know, called Soni Sori, was arrested. She's an Adivasi, an indigenous person who's a school teacher. She was arrested and produced in court and then taken to prison, where she was brutalized. She had stones pushed up her vagina, forcing her to confess. And finally, activists got her to Calcutta to do a medical test where the stones were removed. The stones were then produced in a plastic bag in front of the Supreme Court. And the only result of all that is that she remains in jail, and the policeman who organized her interrogation was given a gallantry award on Republic Day. We hear about the ecological and social re-engineering of central India because there's a mass insurrection and a war. The government gives out no information, and the 24/7 media hasn't helped. How could it? Because you have almost 90% of the turnover, the revenues of the media, comes from corporate advertising. And other than the fact that overtly and covertly these corporations own media houses, by journalists, by editors, the scandals involving the brazen selling of editorial space, where newspapers are basically selling space for good coverage, sometimes blackmailing people with bad coverage unless they are paid. But you also have the other thing, where it's not that corporations own newspapers, but newspapers own mining companies. So one of the biggest Hindi language and other language newspapers called the Dainik Bhaskar. It has 17.5 million readers in four languages, including English and Hindi, across 13 states. It owns 69 companies with interests in mining, power generation, real estate, and textiles. So there's a case against it in court about misusing its newspapers to further its, you know, business. But the point is, it can. It's allowed to. You're allowed to have a newspaper that has a mining corporation and then reports on the resistance in the area. You're allowed to do that. But there are other parts of the country from which no news comes at all. In the sparsely populated but militarized northeastern state of Arunachal Pradesh, 168 big dams are being constructed, most of them privately owned. In Manipur and Kashmir, both densely militarized, they are building dams which will just submerge whole districts. But in Kashmir, 3 weeks ago, I mean, sorry, maybe 6 weeks ago, people were shot to death for protesting against frequent power cuts. How are you going to protest against the building of a dam that's going to drown you when you have 500,000 soldiers there? Another monstrous dam, which has been dismissed as an insane idea 10 years ago, has come back. The Kalpasar Dam in Gujarat, which is conceived as a 35-kilometer-long dam across the Gulf of Kambat. Now, this is a new leap in actually basically building a dam in the sea to keep seawater out. So 35-kilometer-long dam with a 10-lane highway running across it, to create a sweet water reservoir but by keeping seawater out, except that all the rivers have already been dammed and polluted, so you'll have this huge sort of poisonous water reservoir. And the reason it's being built is to supply water to the Dholera Special Investment Region, one of the most water-stressed zones, not just in India, but in the world. It's just another name for a sort of self-governed corporate dystopia of, I quote, industrial parks, townships, and mega cities. It's going to be connected to Gujarat's other cities by a network of 10-lane highways. And where will the money come from? In January 2011, in the Mahatma Gandhi Mandir, you know Gandhi, that great CEO of corporate money, Gujarat's Chief Minister Narendra Modi presided over a meeting of 10,000 international businessmen from 100 countries. According to media reports, they pledged to invest $450 billion in Gujarat. The meeting was deliberately scheduled to take place on the 10th anniversary of the 2002 daylight massacre of more than 1,500 Muslims by right-wing Hindu mobs who were provided with help and logistics by the Gujarat government and police. Narendra Modi stands accused not just of permitting but actually abetting the killing. The people who watched their loved ones being raped, eviscerated, and burned alive still wait for some gesture towards justice. But now Modi has traded in his saffron scarf and vermilion forehead for a sharp business suit and hopes that a $450 billion investment will work as blood money to square the books. And perhaps they will. Many Indian corporate CEOs want him to be the prime minister. The algebra of infinite justice works in mysterious ways. The Dholera Special Investment Region is only one of the smaller Matryoshka dolls. It's one of the inner dolls. And the outer ones will be the Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor, the DMIC, which is a 1,500-kilometer-long, 300-kilometer-wide industrial corridor with 9 mega-industrial zones, a high-speed freight line, 3 seaports and 6 airports, a 6-line intersection, free expressway, and a 4,000-megawatt power plant. It's a collaborative venture between the governments of India and Japan and their corporate partners, and has been proposed by the McKinsey Global Institute. Its website says, the DMIC website, that 180 million people will be affected by the project. They don't say how. It envisages the building of several new cities and estimates that the population in the region will grow from the current 231 million to 314 million in 2019, which is in 7 years' time. When was the last time a state, a despot, or a dictator carried out a population transfer of hundreds of millions of people? Can it possibly be a peaceful process? The Indian Army might need to go on a recruitment drive so that it's not taken unawares when ordered to deploy all across India. In preparation for its new role in central India, it publicly released its updated doctrine on military psychological operations, which outlines, quote, a planned process of conveying a message to a select target audience to promote particular themes that result in desired attitudes and behavior which affect the achievement of political and military objectives of the country. This process of perception management, otherwise called PSYOPs, it said, would be conducted by using, quote, the media available to the services. The Indian Army is experienced enough to know that coercive force alone cannot carry out or manage social engineering on the scale that is envisaged by India's planners for the future. War against the poor is one thing, but for the rest of us, artists, intellectuals, opinion makers, it has to be PSYOPs. And for this, we must turn to the exquisite art of corporate philanthropy. Of late, the main mining conglomerates have taken a great interest in the arts, in film, and in literature. We have a sort of chain of literature festivals now in India, which have replaced the earlier obsession with beauty contests. Vedanta, currently devastating the homelands of the ancient Dongria Kon tribe for bauxite, is sponsoring a Creating Happiness film competition for young students who they've commissioned to make films on sustainable development. Vedanta's tagline is Mining Happiness. He's also building a happy cancer hospital. Perhaps because the processing of bauxite into aluminium creates a toxic effluent called red mud, which, when it's dumped in fields and rivers, does cause problems. Good thinking, good investment opportunity. The Jindals who run steel plants and iron ore mines, they have this sort of cutting-edge art magazine, and some of the biggest artists in India are being encouraged to make stainless steel sculptures and make steel into this cool metal. But all of this is only the burlesque end of the exquisite art of corporate philanthropy. Though the Tatas have been involved with philanthropy for almost 100 years, endowing scholarships and running educational institutions and hospitals, Indian corporations have only recently been given a place at the high table of the Star Chamber, the Camera Stellata, the shadow world of global corporate government, deadly for its adversaries, but otherwise so artful that you barely know it's there. What I'm going to say might sound like a critique. You could also take it as a doffing of the cap by an adversary towards people who have played such a brilliant, ruthless, visionary role in keeping the world safe for capitalism.
You're listening to Arundhati Roy, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. This is Alternative Radio.
The stealthy, enthralling history of corporate philanthropy, which has faded from contemporary memory, began in the U.S. in the early 20th century when corporate philanthropy kitted out legally in the form of endowed foundations began to replace missionary activity as capitalism's and imperialism's road opening and systems maintenance patrol. Right here, barely before I've begun, I've gone and committed heresy. In the world of the Camera Stellata, capitalism and imperialism must never be mentioned in the same breath. In fact, imperialism, may it rest in peace, is a word that must be purged from our vocabulary. Among the first foundations to be set up in the United States were the Carnegie Corporation, endowed in 1911 by profits from the Carnegie Steel Company, and the Rockefeller Foundation, endowed in 1914 by J.D. Rockefeller, founder of the Standard Oil Company, the Tatas and Ambanis of their time. J.D. Rockefeller was America's first billionaire and the world's richest man. He was an abolitionist, a supporter of Abraham Lincoln, and a teetotaler. Some of the institutions financed, given seed money, or supported by the Rockefeller Foundation are the UN, the CIA, the Foreign Relations Council, the Museum of Modern Art, and of course, the Rockefeller Center in New York, where Diego Rivera's mural had to be blasted off the walls because it mischievously depicted reprobate capitalists and a valiant Lenin. Free speech had taken the weekend off. J.D. Rockefeller believed that his money was given to him by God, which must have been nice for him. One of Pablo Neruda's early poems was called Standard Oil Company. I'll just quote a little bit from it. "Their obese emperors from New York." Of course, now the emperors are sleek and the poor are obese, but anyway. "The obese emperors from New York are suave, smiling assassins who buy silk, nylon, cigars, petty tyrants and dictators. They buy countries, people, seas, police, county councils, distant regions where the poor hoard their corn like misers their gold. Standard Oil awakens them, clothes them in uniforms, designates which brother is the enemy. The Paraguayan fights its war, and the Bolivian wastes away in the jungle with his machine gun. A president assassinated for a drop of petroleum, a million-acre mortgage, a swift execution on a morning mortal with light, petrified in Patagonia. A betrayal, scattered shots beneath a petroliferous moon, a subtle change of ministers in the capital, a whisper like an oil tide, and zap, you'll see how Standard Oil's letters shine above the clouds, above the seas in your home, illuminating their dominions." When the Rockefeller Foundation was first set up, many saw it as an attempt to diffuse popular anger against the family for the Ludlow massacre, which was the Rockefellers' Kalinganagar, in which the Colorado National Guard opened fire on a tented colony of 1,200 striking coal miners, killing between 19 and 25 people. When corporate endowed foundations first made their appearance in the U.S., there was a fierce debate about their provenance, legality, and accountability. People suggested that if companies had so much surplus money, perhaps they should raise the wages of their workers. People used to make these outrageous suggestions those days, even in America. The idea of these foundations, so ordinary now, was in fact a leap of the business imagination. Think about it. Non-tax-paying legal entities with massive resources and an almost unlimited brief, wholly unaccountable, wholly non-transparent. What better way to parlay economic wealth into political, social, and cultural capital, to turn money into power? How else would Bill Gates, who admittedly knows a thing or two about computers, find himself dictating, how dare he be dictating, education policy, health policy, agriculture policy, not just to the US government, but to governments all over the world? Over the years, as people witnessed some of the missionary work foundations did, running public libraries, eradicating disease, the direct connection between corporations and the foundations began to blur and eventually faded altogether. Now, even those who consider themselves left-wing are not shy of accepting their largesse. But in the 1920s, U.S. capitalism began to look outwards for raw material and overseas markets, and foundations began to formulate the idea of corporate global government. In 1924, Rockefeller and Carnegie jointly created what is today the most powerful foreign policy pressure group in the world, the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, which later came to be funded by the Ford Foundation as well. By 1947, the newly created CIA was supported by and working closely with CFR. Over the years, the membership of the CFR has included 22 U.S. Secretaries of State. There were 5 CFR members in the 1943 steering committee that planned the UN, which was then built, its headquarters were built with an $8.5 million grant from the Rockefellers. Then the World Bank, the IMF, which later at Bretton Woods decided that universalizing and standardizing business practice in an open marketplace would enhance the penetration of global capital, and that the US dollar would be the reserve currency of the world. All 11 presidents of the World Bank since 1946, the men who have presented themselves as missionaries of the poor, have been members of the FRC, with the exception of George Woods, who was only a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation and the vice president of the Chase Manhattan Bank. Given that the World Bank has more or less directed the economic policies of the Third World, coercing and cracking open the economy of country after country for global finance, you could say that corporate philanthropy has turned out to be the most visionary business venture of all time. The Ford Foundation, liberal foil to the Rockefellers' conservative image, though they work together constantly, was set up in 1936. Its declared goals for the future of mankind included intervening in grassroots political movements, locally and internationally, attempting to shape policy from below as well as above. One of its major interventions has been to provide millions of dollars in grants and loans to support the credit union movement, which actually began in around 1919 when someone called Edward Filene, who was a department store owner, suggested two things. He said, first, that working class people should get cheaper loans, and second, that the national income should be redistributed. Of course, the capitalists seized upon the first and left out the second, and started the business of giving poorer people loans, turning America into a people who have to run to keep up with their own lifestyles. And you know where that's got you. Students especially have been caught in the debt trap. There was a time when you were told that education would be an equalizer, that it would close the gap between rich and poor. But now, as your fees get higher and higher, you're being terrorized into taking bigger and bigger loans to ensure that you get onto the right side of the widening income gap. So your creditors have been bailed out by your government that you voted for with your tax money, and you've been turned into people that your country forgot. Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank in Bangladesh did the same thing to starving peasants. In India, the recent headline of the Hindu said small loans add up to lethal debts, and it says that microfinance companies were responsible for the suicides of 200 people in Andhra Pradesh alone in 2010. A suicide note by an 18-year-old girl who was forced to hand over her last 150 rupees, that's her last $3, her school fees to bullying employees of the company, left a suicide note which said, "Work hard and earn money, do not take loans." You can see there's a lot of money in poverty and a few Nobel Prizes too. After the Second World War, the foundations became actively involved in shaping domestic and foreign policy because communists replaced fascists as enemy number one. And then new institutions were created to deal with that. So the Rand Corporation, and then something called the Fund for the Republic, set up by Ford to thwart the persistent communist effort to penetrate and disrupt free nations. And then gradually to sort of wage the Cold War intelligently without McCarthyist excesses. The Rockefeller and Ford foundations began to work as quasi-extensions of the U.S. government in Latin America, Indonesia, funding NGOs and educational institutions. It played a very crucial part in Indonesia, in the CIA-organized coup, which basically brought General Suharto to power, who then killed tens of thousands of communists. And both Ford and Rockefeller were very much involved in that. Later, as you know, in 1973, when the coup that brought in Pinochet came in, at first young students were taken from Chile to Chicago to study neoliberal economics under Milton Friedman. They were known as the Chicago Boys, who then went back, and after Allende was killed and the markets that he had closed down were reopened, they ran the economy of Chile. So this whole old history sort of continues to affect us in India now, even, imagine. For example, you had Ramon Magsaysay, who was the president of the Philippines, who was a great help in this war against the communists in that area. And now Ford and Rockefeller have endowed this thing called the Magsaysay Award, which is given to community activists in India consider a very, very prestigious prize. And through that, they slowly arbitrate what is acceptable activism, what is not, how to intervene. Like all good imperialists, the philanthropoids then set themselves the task of creating and training an international cadre that believed capitalism and by extension the hegemony of the corporations of the United States was in their own self-interest. And there began the foray into education. And there's a wonderful book called Foundations and Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism by Joan Roelofs, who describes how they remodeled old ideas of teaching, especially of political science, how they developed international and area studies. And this sort of provided a big pool of intelligence for US, for the CIA, for US intelligence to work with. The gathering of information to control people it rules is fundamental to any ruling power. Currently, one of the most ambitious and expensive information gathering projects is a massive biometrics program in India called the Unique Identification Number, embarked on by India's Bill Gates, someone called Nandan Nilekani, on behalf of the government of India. So it's a bit like a digital enclosure of the commons, you know, where you digitize a feudal country where people don't have documents, they don't have papers that say they own land, which they owned before the country existed. But you digitize it and then you exclude them. So this is a process that's happening in India. And this obsession with data, for example, it ties into Bill Gates' obsession with creating these data banks and numerical targets and scoreboards of progress. If Bill Gates had been a shoemaker, maybe he would have believed that shoelaces would be the solution to world hunger. So the Ford Foundation is amongst the biggest funders of the social sciences and the arts, endowing courses, student scholarships in development studies, community studies, cultural studies, behavior science, not just in the US, but across the world. And obviously hundreds of thousands of students from the third world, India, Pakistan, places like that, began to beat down the doors of these elite institutions, including this one. And they became the cadre that then opened the markets, that became the bankers, the lawyers, to run capitalist societies in those spaces. Scholars of the foundation-friendly version of economics and political science were rewarded with scholarships, research funds, grants, endowments, great jobs, a star system. It created a sort of star system amongst academics. And those who had foundation-unfriendly views found themselves unfunded, marginalized, ghettoized, and gradually one particular imagination, cultural pluralism under the roof of a single, overarching, very unplural economic ideology began to dominate the discourse to such an extent that it ceased to be perceived as an ideology at all. It became the default position, the natural way to be. It infiltrated normality, colonized ordinariness, challenging it seemed to be as absurd or as esoteric as challenging reality itself. From here, it was a quick, easy step to there's no alternative. And it's only now, thanks to the Occupy movement, that another language has appeared on US streets and campuses. To see students with banners saying class war, or a woman with a sign that says, I don't mind you being rich, but I mind you buying my government, is, given the odds, almost a revolution in itself. One century after it began, corporate philanthropy is as much part of our lives as Coca-Cola. There are now millions of non-profit organizations, many of them connected through a Byzantine financial maze to larger foundations. And between them, they have assets of $450 billion. So as this structural adjustment makes governments pull out from public spending, the NGOs move in. And the privatization of everything also meant the NGOization of everything. The millions of NGOs, some of them, of course, doing excellent work, are like nodes on the central nervous system, the paths along which global finance flows. They work like transmitters and receivers of information, shock absorbers, alert to every impulse, but careful never to annoy governments of their host countries. And the more trouble the area, the more NGOs you have. And they have entered the world armed with their billions, turning potential revolutionaries into salaried activists, funding artists, intellectuals, filmmakers, concentrating on multiculturalism, identity and gender politics, community development, all of this discourse couched in the language of human rights. The transformation of the idea of justice into the industry of human rights, in which NGOs and foundations have played a very major role, is really a conceptual coup, another conceptual coup. Because justice, if you talk about justice, how can you support policies which are inherently unjust? So you put it away like, you know, some inherited heirloom or some old crockery, and you bring out this much more easy currency of human rights, which NGOs dispense like band-aids to the mortally wounded, without having to address any structural issues. And by manipulating the disbursement of the funds, foundations succeeded in circumscribing the range of what political activity means. And the same thing happened with poverty. You know, it began to be seen as an identity as opposed to a political or social construct. It was like the poor are this lost tribe who capitalism will one day rescue, instead of people who are being created by a certain set of policies. And then you get a certain way of writing about poverty or filming poverty, like Slumdog Millionaire, right? Where you have these wonderful, resourceful, happy, resilient people, but you don't have any villains. Or if you do, they're only local villains for local color, but you don't look at the whole picture together. Now, of course, we have a situation in which the whole new social movements that began with corporate globalization, they coalesced into something called the World Social Forum. That was destabilized by NGOs taking over and deciding which movements would be invited, which would not, what kind of activism was acceptable, what was not. And so in India, in rural areas, people have begun to understand the very, very disturbing role played by these NGOs. But in urban areas, much less so. So then we have now the opposite that happened in India. In the US, you had your foundations that spawned the NGOs. In India, the big foundations are starting now. So you have the Observer Research Foundation by let's say the Reliance people with weapons manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, all these people now together advising the Indian government about strategic policy in the US Cold War against China. And you have, you know, an $80 billion defense budget waiting to be spent. And all these foundations are, you know, sort of preparing the ground for what kind of country India is going to be now. Hugely insecure, hugely weaponized, hugely corporatized. And the point is, do we need weapons to fight wars, or do we sometimes need wars to create a market for weapons? After all, the economies of Europe, US, and Israel depend hugely on their weapons industries, the one thing they haven't outsourced to China. When US President Barack Obama, supposedly the most powerful man on earth, came to India in 2010, he came as little more than a Boeing salesman. In the new Cold War between US and China, is India being groomed to play the role Pakistan played as an ally of the US in the Cold War with Russia? In the list of the Observer Research Foundation, which is the Ambani's foundation, institutional partners, you'll find Rand, Ford Foundation, the World Bank, the Brookings Institute, and also the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. Poor Rosa, who died for the cause of communism, to find her name on a list such as this. They say that capitalism is about competition, but it has also shown itself capable of inclusiveness, promiscuity, and great solidarity. The great Western capitalists have done business with fascists, socialists, despots, and military dictators. They can adapt and constantly innovate and are capable of quick thinking and immense tactical cunning. But perhaps in its stunning success lie the seeds of its destruction. Despite powering through these reforms, despite having waged wars and militarily occupied countries in order to put in place free market democracy, capitalism is going through a crisis whose gravity hasn't revealed itself completely yet. Marx said, "What the bourgeoisie therefore produces above all are its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable." Unfortunately, the proletariat, as Marx saw it, is far from being anywhere close to victory and has been dissolved, divided, and dismantled. Factories have shut down, jobs have disappeared, trade unions have been dismantled. The proletariat has, over the years, been pitted against each other in every possible way. In India, it's been Hindu against Muslim, Hindu against Christian, Dalit against Adivasi, caste against caste, and region against region. And yet, capitalism is in crisis. Trickle-down has failed, but gush-up is in trouble too. How can it not be? The international financial meltdown is closing in. India's growth rate has plummeted to 6.9%. Foreign investment is pulling out. Major international corporations all over the world are sitting on enormous piles of money, not sure where to invest it, not sure how the financial crisis will play out. Capitalism's real gravediggers may end up being its own delusional cardinals who've turned ideology into faith. Despite their strategic brilliance, they seem to have trouble grasping a simple fact. Capitalism is destroying the planet. The two old tricks that dug it out of past crises, war and shopping, simply will not work. What will, we might ask? Whether you're a capitalist or a communist or a Gandhian, whether you're a farmer or a businessman or a student or a poet or a Sufi, I think that we have to agree that we have to dismantle these large monopolies. That is the first step before anything else happens. Those have to be dismantled. There has to be no single individual or entity or corporate can have this kind of unaccountable power and unlimited wealth. I stood outside Antilla for a long time watching the sun go down. I imagined that the tower was as deep as it was high, that it had a 27-story long taproot snaking around below the ground, hungrily sucking sustenance out of the earth, turning it into smoke and gold. Why did the Ambanis call the building Antilla? Antilla is the name of a set of mythical islands whose story dates back to the 18th century Iberian legend. When the Muslims conquered Hispania, six Christian Visigothic bishops and their parishioners boarded ships and fled. After days or maybe weeks at sea, they arrived at the Isles of Antilla, where they decided to settle and raise a new civilization. They burnt their boats to permanently sever their links to their barbarian-dominated homeland. By calling their tower Antilla, do the Ambanis hope to sever their links to the poverty and squalor of their homeland and raise a new civilization? Is this the final act of the most successful secessionist movement in the world, the secession of the upper classes into outer space? As night fell over Mumbai, guards in crisp linen shirts with crackling walkie-talkies appeared outside the forbidding gates of Antilla. The lights blazed on to scare away the ghosts, perhaps. The neighbors complained that Antilla's bright lights have stolen the night. Perhaps it's time for us to take back the night. Thank you.
That was Arundhati Roy, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. She spoke at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. Arundhati Roy, winner of the Booker Prize and the Lannan Award for Cultural Freedom, is the author of many books, including Field Notes on Democracy and Walking with the Comrades. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. That's why we can do programs such as the one you just heard, or others featuring such voices as Tariq Ali, Chris Hedges, Arun Gupta, Richard Wolf, David Corton, Vandana Shiva, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio archive, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Thanks to Zia Mia for recording assistance. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.